Last year, when I was privileged to give a shiur here, I spoke about the relationships between spouses in Tanakh. This morning, I would like to look at the relationships between siblings in Tanakh. It's a very famous line in Pirkei Avot, from which I really take my entire approach to Tanakh, which is Hafol v'hafol v'dechol ava. Turn it over, everything is contained within it. I really believe that the foundations of all knowledge that we have uncovered over the course of the last 4,000 years of the sciences and the arts and technology really is embedded in the Tanakh if we look carefully enough. I come from a background of psychology. I have a master's in psychology. It's one of my great passions. And the basis of the shiur is to look at the relationships between the various sets of siblings in Tanakh, most of which unfortunately went wrong, one most notably, which we'll leave for the end, went right, and use this as a foundation to discuss what would be the optimal type of sibling relationship and what are some of the things to look out for. So the first set of siblings that we encounter in Tanakh is in source number one, in Sefer Bereishit, right literally at the very beginning. Vayehi miketz yamim, it was in the end of days, vayavei kayim mipri ha'adama mincha l'Hashem. So the first set of siblings are the famous brothers Kayim and Heva. Kayim was a farmer, an agriculturalist. According to Rav Hirsch, he was really the forefather of the modern commercial stable civilization. Whereas Hevel, as his name implies, was somewhat more of a floater. He was a shepherd. He was a nomad. He was a wanderer. And it came to a point where Cain and Hevel each realized that they need to recognize the master of the universe with a gift. So Cain gave a gift from his profession, which was agriculture, and Hevel gave a gift from his profession, which was shepherding, so in this case, a sheep. We know the story that Hashem accepted Hevel's korban, Hevel's gift, but he didn't accept Cain's gift. Cain was angry, and at the end of the day, literally and metaphorically, Cain ended up killing Hevel. So the first sibling relationship begins in parity. It seems that they were twins, or if nothing else, they were very close in age. They were the first. It moves into jealousy, and it ends up in murder. Not a very august beginning. The question is what were they really arguing about? And there's a very famous midrash that the Malvin comments on, and I hope I gave you the right one in source number two, which basically asks the question, what were Cain and Hevel arguing about? Why did Cain end up killing Hevel? Bless you. So the Midrash gives three different opinions. One opinion in the Midrash is that they were arguing over ownership of basically what was to become Har HaBayit. And one of them said, namely Cain, says, well, I own the land of Har HaBayit, and therefore the Beit HaMikdash should be built here. Hevel said, well, I own everything that moves over Har HaBayit, so the Beit HaMikdash should be built here. And they argued back and forth, what was more important, was it the karka, the land itself, was it the metalzalim, was it the thing that moved over the karka? And in the end, Cain ended up killing Hevel. The second opinion states that Cain and Hevel were arguing over who had the procreative rights to what seemed to be the only female in the area, namely their mother. We're not going to talk about incest. And Cain felt that since he was the older one, that he had conjugal rights with the woman. Hevel felt he had conjugal rights with the woman, since there were no other women around, apparently. This does not take into account the midrash that Cain and Hevel were each born with a sister. To quote a famous teacher of mine, you can't marry a medrash. And they ended up arguing and killed each other. And then, in the final opinion in the Midrash, Cain and Hevel were basically arguing about whose lifestyle was the better lifestyle. Was it that nomadic kind of lifestyle? Was it, or was it the more stable lifestyle of the agriculturalists? And they ended up killing Cain and killing Hevel. And the Malbim explains that in this Midrash, we basically have the three fundamental bases for war. We have what happened. Everybody has jealousy. Everybody is born with an instinct to have as much as he or she can possibly have. Because the more you have, the better chances you have for survival. The more food you have, the more land you have, the more money you have, the more women you have, the more sheep you have, whatever it is, quantity is power, and power is survival. It's a very basic need that all human beings are born with. Because we are born with that need to survive, and because that translates into a desire to accrue, we view anything that somebody else has as desirable. If they have it, and I don't, that means that I'm at a disadvantage, perhaps. Cain and Hevel were two different people. The fact that Cain was jealous of Hevel is acknowledged by HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. If you go back into source number one, Hashem says, "Vayomer Hashem l'Cain, pasuk vav, lama charama? Why are you angry?" In other words, the jealousy is not being taken to task. It's the reaction. V'lama nafu panecha? Why is your face fallen? Halo itati se'ed, and here I'm going to take the translation of the Hamalevitz. If you improve yourself, you will be able to tolerate the imlam tati, but if you do not improve yourself, lefeta chatat roves, ve'elecha tishukato. If you don't improve, if you don't work on your own feelings of jealousy, feelings which are natural, the competitive drive is a natural, normal, and in fact very adaptive drive. But if you don't work on that drive, if you don't learn how to tolerate and live with the fact that you may not have something that someone else does, then that drive will pursue you, will cling to you, and will cause you to trip and fall. The issue with Cain and Hevel was not so much how Cain felt, but how he was unable to overcome that feeling, and at the end of the day, felt that the only way that he could triumph, the only way that he could assure his own survival, was by killing his adversary, his sibling. The sad irony at the end of the story is that Cain realizes that that doesn't ensure his survival, and ultimately the only thing that does ensure his survival is the sign, is the mark, the oath, whatever it was, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave him. So in this first story of siblings, we see the role of jealousy in a family is an omnipresent emotion. It's going to be there. It's impossible to eradicate the feeling of jealousy that siblings feel for one another, because it's impossible for us to eradicate the jealousy that we feel for anybody who has something that we don't. And one of the best pieces of advice I ever got as a parent was, don't try and force your kids to love each other all the time, because they're not going to. Just make sure they don't kill each other. Ta-da. Okay, so that's the story of Cain and Hevel. We move on now to the next set of siblings in Sefer Bereishit, in the book of Genesis, which is Ishmael and Yitzchak. We know that Ishmael is born in this past week's parasha, Parashat Lech Lecha. He is born to Abraham and his concubine Hagar when Abraham is 86 years old, 14 years later, when Abraham is 100, Yitzchak is born. Hashem tells Abraham that Yitzchak is going to be the heir, Yitzchak is going to be the offspring, and then that continues. So now we see the relationship that is evolving between Yitzhak and Yishmael. Vayigdal hayeled, and the child grew up. And if you want to hear, see another interesting discussion about the word vayigdal, I recommend that you check out Shmot Perek Bet Pasuk Yud Aleph, where Moshe himself comes of age. This idea of vayigdal is an idea that you come of age, you come of some kind of independence, you come to an awareness of who you are and what is your place in society. It's not simply a function of chronology and physical maturity. So the child grew up, vayigamel, and he was weaned. In other words, he's now out from under the protection of his mother. This is the idea of a child becoming an individual. And once you're an individual, then you can start having relationships with other individuals, in this case, Yitzhak and Ishmael. Vayas Abraham Mishtek, Adol, and Abraham made a great party. Vayom Yigamel and Yitzhak, on the day that Yitzhak was weaned. In other words, once Yitzhak, now it kind of was like a pre-bar mitzvah celebration. Yitzhak has survived the first 3 or so years, he's proved his viability as a human being, and he's also beginning to come into his own as a person. And then we see in Pasuk Tet, enter his brother. Vayitzar Sarah, and ben Hagar, and Sarah sees the son of Hagar, Hamitzri, the Egyptian, we'll talk about that in a second, Asher Yalda, that she, meaning Hagar, had given birth to Abraham, Mitzachek. He was mitzachek. I'm purposely not translating that word for a minute. Pasuk Yud. I think we cut a little bit of it off, but basically Sarah says to Abraham, Vayomer Sarah Abraham, or sorry, Vatomer Sarah, but oh, here it is, Vatomer Abraham, and she said to Abraham, Garish Ha'aman Azot, get rid of, drive out this Amah, the Ethbinah, and her son, Kilo Yirash ben Ha'amah, Hazot, and because the son of this maid will not inherit Imbini with my son, with Yitzchak. So the question becomes, what was Ishmael doing that so angered, upset, frightened Sarah, and prompted her into realizing that this couldn't continue? Now remember something. The relationship between Sarah and Hagar was never positive, okay, to say the very least. And Sarah has kicked out Hagar once before. So, and Hagar comes back. So she knows that this is not going to be an easy thing. In fact, you know, later in the parent, Abraham says, no, I don't want to, and it's only God that intervenes. One of my favorite quotes in all of Tanakh, Shema B'Kolah. Listen to that, yeah. It's really interesting, just on a little parenthetical side note, that all of the difficult decisions that have to do with ensuring the survival of the nation are made by women. And I'm not kidding. If you go down the line, from Sarah to Rivka to Tamar, to Miriam, who we're going to get to a little bit later, to Abigail with David, preventing a massive civil war, and all of Ruth, Naomi, you know, there are a lot of them in there. The tough decisions when they're going against us, right? Anyway, so the Mefarshim argue about what it was that Yishmael was doing that was so upsetting. Okay, I want to start with actually source number 5, the Ibn Ezra, because he's a little bit closer to the actual meaning of the pshat, of the simple explanation. Ibn Ezra, source 5, says, Mitzache, ki ben minhag kol na'ar, vatikane va'avur heyoto gadol mibna. Okay, what did he do? What does mitzache mean? It literally means he teased him. He made fun of him. He mocked him. You know, you think you're so great? You're just a little pisher. How come you get to inherit and I don't? Who do you think you are? So the question becomes, why would this lead Sarah to kick out Yishmael? And I believe that one of the sources of her understanding goes back to Yishmael's mother and back to Yishmael's mother's culture, okay? Because we just established that jealousy between siblings is normal and natural. Jealousy does not necessarily lead to murder. It could, but it doesn't have to. But we also know what is in the Egyptian culture, what their response to rivalry is. And we know this from Abraham's response when he goes down to Egypt. He is afraid that they are going to see Sarah, see that she's beautiful, want her, and get rid of him. This was ostensibly something not uncommon in that culture. Yishmael and his mother come from a culture where murder is acceptable to get rid of a rival. So that kind of teasing was not so benign. That kind of jealousy was not so benign. Again, it's the jealousy that's embedded in a culture. Once it becomes culturally accepted to commit murder in order to get what you want, then jealousy is not so kosher. If you live in a society where beating up your sibling and sending them to a hospital is okay because it proves your superiority, then you begin to worry about jealousy between siblings. So she gets rid of him. Notice, she doesn't say that they have to die. She just says, get rid of her. Okay? This is a very psychologically adaptive and sound solution to a problem. If you hit a situation that really isn't ameliorable, you can't make it better because you know that the end result is going to be disastrous and irreparable, namely murder, you get out of that situation. Not every situation is resolvable. Not even a situation between siblings. And sometimes you just have to separate them. And sometimes you have to separate them for good. This is obviously an extreme. Okay, we turn now. I'm going to let you read the Ramban on your own because it's very long and I have a tendency to run out of time. So I'm going to go back to Rashi, which is the more famous explanation. Rashi translates and he uses a lot of different sources from all over Tanakh, but basically he says Mitzachei could mean one of three things. Mitzachei could either be referring to Avodah Zarah, idolatry, which we know is not just a matter of bowing down to something made of wood or something made of stone, but in fact, again, it's an entire lifestyle. I would refer you to the early chapters of Mishnah's The Source for like a really great glimpse into what pagan, what idolatrous society was like, or if you want to check out the Iliad, the Odyssey. Basically, it was the kind of mentality, again, where might made right. The bigger, the more, the richer, the more justified. He who had the gold made the rules. There was no concept that everybody is equal in the eyes of God, and ultimately everybody has a responsibility, the same responsibility to one creator because everyone's created in some manner too. So in one opinion, Yishmael was trying to subvert Yitzhak's spiritual beliefs. And his spiritual beliefs weren't just beliefs. It's very difficult to conceptualize in a world where pretty much everybody is monotheistic. And even somebody who might be a confirmed agnostic and doesn't know whether they believe in a religion or not will still accept that there's some master creator. You want to call that master creator Mother Nature, that's fine. But there's kind of one force out there in the world. It's very, very difficult for us to conceptualize a time when there were multiple masters. And basically the strongest master won. Whoever threw the furthest firebolt, whoever created the biggest storm at sea, whichever army won the battle, that was who the master was. That was who was the greatest god. And that was whose people had the most rights. So basically what Ishmael was trying to do was to take Yitzhak away from everything that Abraham had fought for and stood for and return Yitzhak to everything that Abraham had just left. And Sarah said, no. We didn't spend our whole lives fighting for what we believed in to have this Egyptian child, even though he is half Abraham, subvert our child's beliefs. So again, when you have a sibling relationship where one sibling basically is trying to undermine the morality of another sibling, One sibling is trying to reduce the other sibling to drink, to do drugs, to go with him on a crime spree. That's not closeness. That's subversion. And that's the kind of relationship that a parent needs, or a community needs, or a school needs to step in and say, no, this is not a healthy sibling relationship. Another thing that Rashi says is that Yishmael was making homosexual advances at Yitzchak. There was sexual play going on. And again, I mean, I don't need to get into the topic of incest. It's something that's a very uncomfortable topic. It's a very difficult topic. But if there is any suspicion whatsoever on the part of a parent or the part of a school or the part of a caretaker, that's not closeness. That's violation. And Sarah realized that. That's not innocent play. Especially if you keep in mind that there's a 13-year difference between these two boys. And that by the time Yitzchak is 3, Yishmael is 16. And the sexual outlook of a 16-year-old is going to be very different than the sexual outlook of a 3-year-old. And the 16-year-old is in a tremendous position of power and authority to take advantage of the 3-year-old. I recently read a statistic that there are almost as many cases of close relative sexual abuse of children as there is of parental sexual abuse of children. So the Torah is telling us, and the Gemara is telling us, you know, books that were written 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years ago, that this kind of relationship with siblings is not okay. And finally, I guess the most obvious one that's not okay is the opinion that says that Yishmael was actually trying to kill Yitzchak. I just want to throw out one more opinion that I learned from my mentor, Dr. Esther Stubb, in Chicago. And she said as follows, what does it mean that Sarah saw that Yishmael was mitzachek? She interpreted it as that Sarah saw that Yishmael was trying to be Yitzchak. He was Yitzchaking. He was imitating Yitzchak in an attempt to get in with the good graces of his father. So you wouldn't think that this is necessarily a bad thing. I mean, we acknowledge Yitzchak in a way as being the most righteous, the most angelic, the most pure of the 3 uncles. One would think that this would be a good thing for his older sibling to be emulating that kind of purity. But when it's an emulating that, again, is looking to seek gain, when it's low lishma, it's not really for its own sake. And remember, he's 16, 17, 18. He's not a little kid. He's a mature, almost adult. When there's an ulterior motive, you have to look closely at why all of a sudden an older adolescent makes a radical behavior change. Remember, Yitzchak is said by HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself, he will be a para adam, he will be a wild man. Okay? So if all of a sudden this wild man decides to become this kind and gentle and bookish and sweet soul who spends his day cuddling puppies in his lap, you kind of have to take a look and say, okay, either this kid has had some kind of epiphany, or there's something more nefarious going on. And in the case of Yishmael, Sarah realized that there was something more nefarious going on. And she tells Yishmael and Hagar, you have to leave. You don't have to die. And by the way, according to the Code of Hammurabi, she would have been within the rights to kill Yitzchak. As a threat to her own son. I'm sorry, to kill Yishmael, thank you. As a threat to her own son. She was the master. She basically could do with this maidservant's child as she liked. So while to us throwing out Hagar and Yishmael seems cruel, it was within her legal rights to do so, and more so, she clearly felt that was a case of pikuach nefesh. Moving right along, we go down to source number 8. Yes. Probably the most famous set of two siblings, Yaakov and Lisa. Okay, we know, and I guess this is my bad that I didn't start in the beginning of Toldo. We know that when Rivka is pregnant with the twins, she feels that there's a lot of movement in her belly. And she goes, Midrosha to Elohim, she goes to find out from Hashem, from a Navi, from whoever, however, what's going on? And she gets a nevuah, basically, that these two, they will be twins, they will be siblings, and they will always be fighting one with the other. But what's interesting is how they're born. The acharei came, pasuk kafav, source number 8, verse 26, and afterwards, yatsa echad, his brother came out, v'yado ochezet ba'akev esa. And his hand was grabbing onto the heel of Isa, vayikrashmo Yaakov. And they called him Yaakov, in other words, the heel, so to speak, the Yitzchak ben Shishi Shana, the Leden Otam, and Yitzchak was 60 when they were born. One of the things that fascinates me about Midrash is its political agenda. We don't often think about the fact that Midrashim were written down as Darash and Al-Pen in a time period. The Midrash was written down beginning, by most accounts, somewhere around Hanukkah. The beginning, the earliest Midrashim seem to date back to about 170-175 BCE, and some of the latest Midrashim go all the way to the time of Tzibor-Rahim in about 500-600 CE. Most of the Midrashim that we are the most familiar with, namely those Midrashim from Midrash Rabbah, were written down somewhere between 50 CE and 200 CE. In other words, in the Tanaitic period, and many of them, around the Tanaitic period, and if we kind of scroll back into our world history a little bit, it's not a coincidence that a lot of these midrashim that look at the enemy within, whether it's Esau, whether it's Lavan, whether it's Satan, however you want to look at it, the enemy within as the most dangerous enemy. Because these were the early days of Christianity. We have to remember that Paul of Tarsus started all out as Rabbi Shaul. That the earliest Christians were rabbis. They were some of the peers of the Tanaim that we have in our Mishnah. They were the peers of Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yehuda. When I was in Caesarea a few years ago, there was really a fascinating one of these historical multimedia things. If you ever go to Caesarea, I highly recommend it. What I did not know about Rabbi Abahu, who lived in Caesarea, was his basic job in the town was to keep peace between the Jews, the Christians, and the Romans, or the Jews, the new Jews, and the Romans. Because as far as the Romans were concerned, it didn't matter whether you were an Orthodox Jew or a Reformed Jew. I say to my students, the early Christians were basically the equivalent of modern Reformed Judaism. They considered themselves Jews. And they were all too happy to have these new Christians and the old Jews, or the new Jews and the old Jews, kill each other. So Rabbi Abahu spent a lot of time doing shuttle diplomacy between the two communities and making sure that neither one was malshing the Romans, because he knew that the Romans would be only too happy to kill them all out and take Caesarea completely for themselves. More housing, more space, bigger port. So we know Asa through Midrash as a bad egg. He, in many ways, represents real evil. And because he's so evil, the Midrash can justify everything that Yitzchak and Rivka and Yaakov did to ensure the survival of Bnei Yisrael. But if we look at the facts on the ground, we cannot get away with the fact that what Yaakov and Rivka did wasn't completely above board. And the Ramban and many, many other Parshanim discuss the fact that Yaakov, meaning heel, meaning trickster, Zed, Yaakveni Zed Pa'amayim, is his name.
And then HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself had to come down and change that name from Yaakov to Yisrael. That to some degree, Yaakov is who he is because of what he did. And what he did was perhaps not the best thing. Aviva Zornberg, in a lecture that I heard from her about 10 years ago, said that sometimes, yes, the Torah tells us, sometimes you have to walk. However, you have to be a Yaakov or a Yosef to know when those sometimes are. So kind of taking that musar of sometimes you have to lie and applying it to us is a very dangerous precedent. But what the Torah is showing very clearly is that there are times when lying and trickery, where the ends do justify the means. From the moment, and this is, I refer you to the Rav's famous article about Yaakov and Esav and the interchange or the interface between Jews and their Christian brethren. Yaakov is born holding Esav's heel. From the second they enter the world, the enemy within is connected to you, or you are connected to it. You can't ignore it. In other words, you can't ignore the tension that's going to exist between siblings. You can't ignore the fact that you have one personality. You are an Ish Tam Yoshev Ohalim. You are bookish. You are a techno geek. You are a good boy. And your brother is a bad boy surfer dude. Okay? Or biker dude. Or whatever kind of bad boy dude he is. Now, Esav is not a murderer. Esav is not a thief. Esav is not an Olam Hazeh. Esav is an Ish Tzayin. Esav is a hunter. He's that motocross, biker, skateboard, long-haired, ear-pierced, punk rocker boy. But he's not a bad boy. Because if he was a bad boy, Yitzchak really wouldn't have loved him. He was Yitzchak's alter ego. He was everything Yitzchak knew that he wasn't, but Yitzchak wouldn't have loved a child that was evil or bad. But Esav was different. And what Rivka realized was twofold. Number one, she had a nevuah from HaKadosh Baruch Hu that Esav wouldn't be it. That's a pretty compelling argument. But again, going back to Yishmael, similarly, the question that we have to ask ourselves is what happens when that ear-pierced biker dude, when he's 14, 15, 16, what's going to happen to him when he's 20, 21, 22, if the miracles of Yeshivot in Israel don't do their job? Or maybe he won't go. Okay? Or maybe he will go and come back unchanged. Then what happens? So it's not that Esav is inherently bad. It's not that he's inherently evil. It's not that he's inherently evil. But what what I think the Torah is telling us is that you can have a physical child. You can have a boy who's not going to sit in the Beit Midrash all day. You can have a child who is beloved to his father, to Yitzchak, who is out there in the wild with the animals, who has a more passionate, a more red, a more that kind of personality. David HaMelech was also a redhead. It's not something that's inherently bad. Yaakov didn't dislike Esav. Esav didn't dislike Yaakov. We have no record of the fact that they didn't like each other. We have no record of the fact that they didn't get along. From everything that the text tells us, is that, okay, they got along pretty well. And that whole scene with the soup, they were 15. What 15-year-old isn't going to try and be a little bit of a punk to his hungry brother that's out, you know, the big buff brother who probably got all the girls? And I'm sorry, as far as I'm concerned, Esav, if he was that hungry, could have continued walking and gotten some food himself. I don't see either one of them as the victim or as the innocent in that little escape. Was Yaakov circuitous? Yes. Was Esav foolish? Yes. Neither one of them is evil. It's only once Asa feels tricked out of that which was his father's bracha, not even necessarily supremacy. What does it say? Vayitzak tzaka gedola umara. He doesn't threaten to kill Yaakov right away. The first thing that we hear from Esav is that deep, visceral cry of bitterness. It is the same cry of bitterness that Sisera's wife was given the zechut for 100 kolot on Rosh Hashanah. Sorry, thank you. Wrong wife.
All right.
It is a deep tzaka in the Tanakh, as much as it is a cry, is used as lashon tefillah, a lashon of prayer, a lashon of davening. It was a soul cry. And you'll forgive me, but Esav had every right to cry that cry. He loved his father. He wanted his father's bracha. He had worked his entire life, and I think if you do the calculus, I think they were about 75 at that point already. Right? We think of Yaakov and Esav at the moment of the bracha as probably being about 20, but if you go and figure it out, I did this once with my students who are generally better at math than I am. When Yaakov arrived in Paran, he was like 75 years old. They coexisted very peacefully, very happily for 75 years. To me, this is a really great model of how two siblings that are very different can grow up in the same household and live together and not murder each other and not subvert each other. But there came a point where it just didn't work anymore. And that point was when Yaakov took from Esav the one thing that Esav wanted more than anything else, and that was his father's love. And we know this about siblings also. That at the end of the day, what siblings want are their parents' love and approval. And it doesn't, and if they can tolerate each other's differences, they can tolerate each other's success, it comes down to the parents' love. I know of one very, very tragic story of a family. There were four siblings. Very, very, very wealthy family that I encountered through my years of teaching. Bottom line is that there was a fallout between, there were two boys, two girls, between the two boys, the two brothers. Why? Because each one thought that the father favored the other. That fallout ended up in two sets of siblings, one brother, one sister, one brother, one sister, sitting shiva for the father in two ends of a house. And the end result was it ended up in certain issues, in certain dealings that landed one of the two brothers behind bars. It had nothing to do with money. It had nothing to do with religion. It had nothing to do with wit. It had to do with their father's love. So, to me, this is incredibly humbling as a parent. As much as I joke when one child complains about the other, why, blah, 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 and I'm like, okay, because I like him better, or because I like her better, usually shuts them up, because Baruch Hashem, I hope that my children know that it's the love that I have for the two of them and the love that their father has for the two of them is the same kind of love. If Yitzchak made one mistake as a parent, it wasn't favoring his son. Be that as it may, the one thing that Esav couldn't tolerate as a sibling that turned him to a murderous rage was having his brother take from him that primal, basic emotional attachment that he had with his father. And what's fascinating, actually, about Esav and Yaakov is that at the end of the day, they learn to live with each other's existence. They make some kind of peace accord. But the only way they can exist is by coexisting, by leading parallel lives in different places, in different landscapes. And Esav never got over that being thwarted. It doesn't surprise at all that Amalek is his grandson. It took two generations to distill Esav's anger. That's pure evil. Anger without cause. Anger that has no basis. Anger that is unforgiving. That's Amalek. Esav forgave Yaakov. Moving right along. Yosef and his brothers. Oh, what a wonderful story. It's a cautionary tale to any parent. I think we are in source 12. How far do we get here? I have to turn the page. No, we went down to 11? No. Oh, did we miss this one? Great. My bad. Refer to your local Tanakh. Story of Yosef and his brothers begins in Sefer Bereishit, Perek Lamed Zayin, chapter 37. And this is, in a way, people say there's no comedy in the Tanakh. This is almost comically tragic. Because, again, it's a story of sibling rivalry that goes terribly awry. But at the end of the day, it's also the first case of sibling triumph. It's our first scenario where the rivalry of the individual is set aside for the good of the whole. And in Parshat Vayigash, when Yehuda steps forward, when Yehuda, the child of Leah, steps forward to see the child of Rachel, which is a whole different rivalry, and that's in some of the previous sources, and I'm keeping an eye on one of those clocks, the one that's actually right, that one, because I want to get to Moshe. Rachel and Leah are their own tragic tale, which I'll talk about in 1 second, but Yehuda steps forward, Yehuda the child of Leah, steps forward, risks his own life and his own neck, and volunteers his own self in place of the child of Rachel. The brothers all knew that Yaakov loved Rachel best. Rachel and Leah knew that Yaakov loved Rachel best. Some of the saddest conversations in the book of Bereishit is that conversation, and I think it's here somewhere in the sources, maybe, I think it's source number 13. Yeah. Pasuk Yudalev. Vayelech Ruvain, he made Hatzir, the oldest child of Leah. Ruvain always is the man of good intentions. He's the classic ADD kind of kid. Great heart, great intentions, not great foresight. So Ruvain goes, Vayelech Hatzir, in the time of the wheat harvest, and he gets these dudahim, these man grapes, these aphrodisiac fertility type of herbs. Basadev, Yaveh, Otam, Eleah, and he brings them to Leah, but which Leah? His mother. Batoma Rachel Eleah. By the way, no, it's in the same pasuk. It means that Ruvain must have just gotten there. Rachel was there, and she sees it. And she's Batoma Rachel Eleah. Tnina li dudahimineh. Give me some of your son's flowers, some of that fertility medication. She didn't have any. Batoma la. We don't even have Leah's name here. That's how marginalized she feels. Hana'at kachtech et ishti. Ishi. Is it such a small thing to you that you've taken my husband, my man, v'lakachat gam et dudei b'ni, you also want to take my aphrodisiac infertility drugs, the ones that my son, yes, I believe this was a jab, brought to me, v'toma Rachel, and Rachel says, l'chein lishkav imach halayim. Yaakov's name is never mentioned here either. Yaakov, he will sleep with you tonight. Tachat udehem. In place of this medication. So Leah and Rachel each has what the other one wants. Leah has children. Rachel feels worthless without them. Rachel has the love of her man. Yes, her adoration, his passion,
Vayehav, he loved her. I think it's the first time that that word is used in Tanakh about a man who was a woman, that he loved her. Vayinafeh, he was comforted first, but he loved her on sight. It was the great romance of Chumash. That doesn't matter to Rachel. She has, what she wants is what her sister has. Leah feels nameless, Rachel feels worthless. To me, however, what the triumph of Rachel and Leah is, and this probably has to do with the psychology of women and the fact that we are ever attempting to accommodate and coexist, is that they do. This is the only time that we hear some kind of bitter word between them. The foundation of our redemption, of our Geula, is based on the fact that Rachel allows her rival, her sister, to marry her beloved and not she. In an incredibly beautiful midrash in Sefer Yirmiyahu, Kol Birama Nishma, Rachel Mibakal Banecha. Rachel is the one crying for her children. And the midrash explains how each one of the Avot and the Imahot came before HaKadosh Baruch Hu and begged him not to destroy, not to exile the Jews. And he doesn't listen to them. And finally, Rachel comes up to God and she says, I allowed my rival into my house. I allowed her into my house. I gave her the wherewithal. I gave her the signs so that she should not be humiliated. I gave up marriage with my husband. I gave up individual rights to my husband for the rest of my life for my rival. And she lived with me side by side in my house. You, the master of the universe, cannot tolerate a rival in your house. HaKadosh Baruch Hu conceives and he says, Rachel, stop crying. Your sons will come back. You're right. Basically, God says to Rachel, you're right. Because what Rachel and Leah, despite their rivalry, despite their jealousy, despite their personal anguish, were able to demonstrate was that you can live with all of that. And you can still raise a quasi-functional family that becomes the foundation for an amazing nation. Rivalry and jealousy is not necessarily a death knell. You have to work beyond it. You have to look for the good of the whole. You have to accept each other. Yaakov and Esav basically accepted each other as different. Rachel and Leah basically accepted each other as different. And they worked together, Rachel and Leah, to raise these 12 sons who eventually went on to become the basis for Klal Yisrael. And as much as our Tanakh talks about all of the bad things that happened, we forget, for example, that 38 years in the Midbar were quiet and peaceful and everybody is doing a great job. And we forget the fact that the big first Beit HaMikdash stood for almost 500 years. And then the second one stood another 500 years. 1,000 years of a theocracy is a pretty decent track record. We tend to look at the Chorban. We tend to look at the negative. We forget the fact that these societies function. There's going to be rivalry. There's going to be dysfunction. The question is, at the end of the day, can you make it? Perhaps the greatest success story of siblings is that when they were different genders. And that's Moshe and Miriam. Okay, we know we're now at source 14. And I'm just going to wrap up. Source 14. By the beginning of Perek Bet, Sefer Shemot, Vayikach ish mi beit Levi et bat Levi. And a man from the house of Levi took the daughter of Levi as a wife. And in a midrash there, it says, what did he take? He took the advice of his daughter. Because his daughter came to him and she said, Abba, you're worse than Paro. Paro's only killing off the boys, but by your separating from your wife and you as the oldest child of the head shaven at that time was Levi, and everybody else followed suit and left their wives, you're effectively killing all boys and all girls. So Amram went back to Yocheved had Aaron, and Amram went back to Yocheved, and then had Moshe. I'm sorry, Aaron was already born, and had Moshe. Miriam, in effect, as Moshe's sister, ensures his survival, and in doing so, ensures the survival of Bnei Yisrael. And we see an intensely protective, close relationship. Sometimes perhaps too close, and we know that what happens when siblings sometimes get too close and too intertwined, Vatidaber Miriam, the Aaron b'Moshe, they talk about Moshe. She's so close that she doesn't see the difference between them. I'm a Navi, he's a Navi. I talk to God, he talks to God. He sings a song at Yom Suf, I sing a song at Yom Suf. I say to my students when we learn about Miriam, I should go through 126 years of life and have one sin to my name. I'd like to go through 126 minutes, seconds, without one sin to my name. You know, we get kind of really hung up on this Lashon Hara of Miriam. That was one chait in 126 years. Not a bad legacy. And one of the explanations, and this I think is the last source, for why Moshe ends up with hitting the rock instead of talking to him, is that we forget what happens immediately before. Source number 17, Vayavok b'nei Yisrael, Koleida, they all come, Midbar Tzin, they come to Midbar Tzin, the Chodesh Rishon, the first month, Vayesh Ha'am, the Kadesh, and the Am sat in Kadesh, but Tamat Sham Miriam, but Tikaber Sham. Miriam dies. Your sister, your lifesaver, your support system, your closest probably female confidant, your peer, your mother figure dies. It doesn't surprise me much that Moshe, in that moment of personal grief, and unfortunately people in leadership positions don't really get much personal time, messes up. That was his one mistake. It was a mistake born of grief, born of sadness, born of loneliness, born of that sense that the one female who probably really got who he was, because we know it wasn't Sipora, is gone. So, just to sum up very quickly, sibling relationships are going to be jealous relationships, they're going to be rivalrous relationships, and they're not going to be perfect relationships. At the end of the day, what matters is if there's understanding, compassion, love, and a willingness to work together for the greater good. If you can end up like Moshe and Miriam, basically best friends, that's the icing on the cake. Have a great day.